Latter-day Saint Home Educators is pleased to bring you this audio presentation, recorded live during the 2017 Home Education Conference, held in Williamsburg, Virginia.
Some thoughts concerning education argued an argument that resonates with homeschoolers, right? He said, the knowledge gained in public schools is produced too dearly at the cost of innocence and virtue. We pay a heavy price for the knowledge that we get in public education. Association with bad boys, okay, because this was back in the day when girls didn't go to school, right? This is like, so bad boys are produces coarseness, not manliness. Vices soon take root and unavoidably develop. The higher aim of education is virtue, which in the private system, in the home, will be more likely achieved because the child associates more with his parents and select society, right? This might sound elitist, maybe it was back in his day, right? But I think it kind of resonates with homeschoolers, and I'll try to connect it in a minute here. While the decision to educate children at home is motivated by many factors, home educators generally share Locke's concern. They perceive that public education as an agent of socialization can have a negative impact on their ability to pass virtue and values onto their children. Right. So in other words, one of the reasons why homeschoolers homeschool, I mean, there's lots of reasons why homeschoolers homeschool, but one of the reasons is this idea of conveying the values and controlling that process for your child's life so that they don't get the wrong kinds of values, right? In short, one of the reasons they become home educators was to protect their children from the risks of negative socialization, right? From what I understand, you're all, and this is a beginner's workshop. So how many of you like are already homeschooling or already made the decision to homeschool? A few of you. How many of you would say, raise your hand if that's, I know that this is being recorded and the people listening can't see this, but how many of you would say that that's a concern for you? The idea of negative socialization that happens in the schools is part of your motivation for homeschooling. There you go. That's almost every hand that was raised of people who are already homeschooling or made the decision to, that's a part of it, right? At the same time though, home educators, so you people have neighbors, friends, family who express a very different concern. That withdrawal from the public school will create children who are socially incompetent and ill-equipped to face the challenges of life, right? This opposing view suggests that the socialization occurring in public schools positively impacts children. For these neighbors, friends, and family, the risk of negative socialization occurs when children are withdrawn from public school, not when they're enrolled in public school. So you see these very different views, right? Like, I'm concerned about the negative socialization that happens in school, so I'm going to homeschool my kids. And then you have neighbors who say, you know, I'm concerned that you're, you know, or family even, or parents who are saying, I'm concerned that you're withdrawing your children from school because that's going to be negative socialization, right? Which is kind of an interesting idea to play around with, right? So in sum, home educators are often motivated by a concern that children in public school will develop skewed values, while their neighbors, friends, and families sometimes raise concerns that withdrawal from school will make their children social misfits. Now, how many of you, again, I'm just curious, those of you who are already involved in this or already talking to your neighbors and family and friends about it, have already heard the concerns about your kid being a social misfit, right? They're going to grow up socially retarded. You know, they won't know how to talk to people or make friends, or they'll be isolated and lonely and disconnected or have emotional problems or anxiety, or it goes on and on, right? You hear those are all versions of the same concern. Okay, so my purpose today is really twofold. First of all, I want to provide you with a description of socialization as a developmental process so that you can, okay, so here are the two parts. Understand how to talk to neighbors, friends, and family about this concern, right? So if you understand how socialization works, then you can explain to your neighbors so they won't be so concerned, or your parents or your family or whatever. And then the other part is I want to give you some insights that will help you facilitate your children's healthy socialization, right? So hopefully this is what we're going to do today. Okay, so more overview stuff. I'm going to go over some socialization basics. I'm not going to talk about a whole lot about research studies. There'll be a little bit of discussion about research at the very end, but I'm going to basically give you some of the, you know, the conceptualization of socialization, what it is and the theory about it and how it's supposed to work and some of the basics, patterns of in the research that we see. But I'm not going to talk specifically today a whole lot about research that looks at socialization of homeschooled children, and I'll explain why later on. So we're going to cover some basics of socialization, parents and peers as agents of socialization across development, conclusions about the socialization process based on, again, theory and some of the bigger trends in research that aren't not about homeschool but about socialization in general, and then some common misunderstandings about socialization that are motivating your friends and family to raise these concerns about social misfits. And then we're going to talk about strategies for talking to other people about socialization, because I've had lots of practice, because I didn't just talk with my friends and family, but I teach classes about, I teach a parenting class, I teach a child development class, I teach a marriage and family class, I teach all these classes where homeschooling stuff comes up, and the students always raise all these concerns, and over the years, I've had lots of practice with all kinds of different arguments. I've tried this argument, and I've tried all kinds of different arguments with my students to see if I can break them out of their bias that homeschoolers are misfits, right? They'll even point to other kids and say, look at so-and-so, he was homeschooled, and just look at him, right? I mean, right in class like that, like in a class, in front of everybody, they'll do things like that. They're so, they can't see the wrongness of it. And so sometimes it's hard talking them out of it, but I've had lots of practice trying to propose arguments to persuade people that their concerns are misinformed. Okay, and then we'll talk about strategies for socialization, things that you can do as a parent with your children to help increase the likelihood that they'll have healthy, normal socialization development, social development. Okay, so socialization basics. Okay, so the definition. Okay, so the process by which parents and others, this is the definition of socialization. It's the process by which parents and others ensure that a child's standards of behavior, attitudes, values, skills, and motives conform to those deemed appropriate by society. The big picture is that it's so that when your child grows up into an adult, your child is a healthy, normal, well-adjusted adult. That's kind of the socialization process. How do you help turn kids into adults in a healthy way, right? Examples of this. Behaviors, for example. Behaviors like swearing, knowing that you shouldn't swear, or knowing that you shouldn't talk in theaters. Please educate your kids that they shouldn't talk in theaters, because that really drives me crazy. Bullying. Speeding, vandalism, music choices, drug abuse, dress and grooming standards, all these things are kind of like behavioral things that we would lump those into that whole business of socialization. Attitudes about things like attitudes about women, about minorities, about the environment, about punishment of sex offenders, about whatever, just attitudes about all kinds of things. Values, the sanctity of life, the importance of family, freedom, honesty, education, work ethic, all these sorts of values are a part of socialization. And then finally, skills, like practical skills that you need in life, like communication skills, conflict resolution, how to make your bed, how to drive a car, how to shop for groceries. These are all kinds of things that adults need to do in order to function in society, right? So socialization is this really huge, broad umbrella kind of concept that we're talking about here, right? Okay. There are various agents of socialization, and this is, I'm sure you guys already know this, but I just want to lay it all out before we start talking. Parents are an important agent of socialization, as are siblings, teachers, friends, clergy, peer groups, and of course the media, TV and social media and all these other influences, right? There's lots of different agents of socialization sending messages to your children about how they should behave or what their values should be, on and on. The different agents affect different aspects of socialization to different degrees. Now, this is important. This is an important distinction. So, for example, having a parent or an older sibling who smokes more strongly predicts children's smoking behavior than does having peers or friends who smoke. So, if you want to look at something like, you know, whether or not a kid's going to start smoking at an early age, whether his friends and peers smoke isn't as important as whether someone in his family smokes. Right? So it's not like all these agents are equal in their influence or even equal in specific areas of influence. There's complexity there, and it's nuanced. Right? Okay, socialization in early childhood. Let's talk about that. Parents in early childhood are clearly, you know, just boatloads of research would suggest that parents are clearly the key agent of socialization in early childhood. You have a lot of influence, a lot of control. There are many ways, there are several ways in which parents influence their children in social ways. First of all, as an interactive partner, right? You are playing peekaboo with your baby and teaching your baby turn-taking by the way you talk to your baby, or you are, you know, modeling behavior like how to sit at the table and eat your food, or you're, like, there's all kinds of, well, modeling's another one, sorry, bad example. But as an interactive partner, talking with your kid, playing with your kid, dad doing rough and tumble play with the kids is teaching them important lessons about relationships and aggression management and all kinds of things, right? As an instructor, so you're going to tell your kids how to behave. You shouldn't, you should be nice to your sister, right? Don't hit your sister, you know, use your indoor voice, whatever. So you do, you give instructions, you provide resources. You, for example, might get your kids into a play group or put your kids in sports teams or dance class or get them musical instrument lessons. Or so you're a resource to help them get into other avenues that will further socialize them, right? So, yeah. And then managers. Yeah, I guess resources and managers, I kind of fuddled those. Because the managers is the idea that you might control what kind of other, like, for example, how many of you have policies about how much TV happens in your house, right? That's an example of you managing. You're a manager of all these other socializing forces in your child's life, right? So, yeah, so lots of so key ways in which you as a parent get to control the socialization process of your child, right? Okay, so play with siblings, friends, and peers provides, here's another key idea in early childhood socialization. Your kids having friends and siblings to play with, and even peers in peer groups like on the playground, things like that, provides them with information about the world outside the family, provides them with an opportunity to practice skills, including social skills, and is provides a standard for comparison, right? A peer group allows your child to make comparisons about how am I doing, or how good am I at this, or how do I fit in this area of, you know, my communication or friendliness, or, you know, how fun am I, or how smart am I, or whatever. So it allows you to make comparisons with others, right? So these are some key ideas. Let's go to middle childhood. I've got to keep my phone on. As I said, I got to track my time well, because I do want to have time. Oh, I didn't announce it, but I'm assuming that we'll just take questions at the end. But if any of you really have a burning question that you want to ask while I'm going, I won't be offended. No judging. Just raise your hand and ask the question, okay? So socialization in middle childhood. So the parent in middle childhood is still key, but probably less in terms of being the direct interaction that you have with your child. Now, of course, this is all this research I'm giving you is sort of assuming a non-homeschool experience. Like, obviously, like our kids, when they were growing up, still had a boatload of interaction with my wife and a lot of interaction with me because they were homeschooled, right? But I guess this is research based on your typical sort of public schooled kid. But anyways, in middle childhood, parents are still key. There's less direct interaction happening, but all those other resources, management, modeling, all that stuff is still happening in big and important ways. Supportive friendships become more important agents of socialization in middle childhood. Now, I want to, every time I talk about friendship today, if I don't qualify by saying supportive friendship or high quality friendship or something like that, throw something at me and remind me, because the research isn't just about your kids having friends, but about having supportive friends, having friends that are good for them. There are like, you know, conflict-ridden friendships or coercive friendships. There's negative processes in some friendships that can be very harmful and destructive to children. So supportive friendships are a very good thing, though. They're going to be an important aspect of socialization. Friendship fulfills six functions. So let's go through some of those. Companionship. Oh, by the way, I'm pulling a lot of this stuff from really basic, you know, some of the most, like, this is Piaget, right? The functions of friendship for children, right? Some of this stuff really comes from very basic theorists about development in children's lives, right? This isn't like any kind of homeschool research or anything like that, right? So companionship, a familiar partner for collaborative activities. That's an important function of friendship. Stimulation, so there's interesting information, there's excitement, there's amusement. Children need friends because a good friendship provides stimulation, right? Physical support, so there's resources and assistance that can sometimes come through friendships. That's probably less common in middle childhood, but ego support, this is probably the one that's more common, right? Encouragement and feedback that helps children feel competent, attractive, worthwhile. Right, little boys and girls, middle school kids do this kind of stuff for each other. And then social comparisons, once again, information about where you stand compared to others. And the friend helps you to filter all that in hopefully positive and encouraging ways, right? Intimacy and affection. So warm, close, trusting relationships that include self-disclosure. So children start to learn about the processes of intimacy through friendships, right? And intimacy involves things like personal disclosure and sharing, you know, talking about feelings and, you know, things like that. Okay, so there's some basic ideas about socialization in middle childhood. And now we get to adolescence. Okay, so parents, once again, I would say parents are still a key. They're not the single most important influence, but they're still a key socializing agent in children's lives. I would hazard a guess, I think it would be safe to guess that in a lot of homeschooled families, even into adolescence, parents are going to be the main socializing agent, because you're going to be spending so much time with your children and interacting with them and providing so much information for them. But again, like I would say for most public school kids, the parents are still key, but probably the interaction isn't happening as much at this point, definitely. And then the idea of direct instruction isn't happening as much in adolescence for typical families, right? But the modeling and the resources and those things, the managing, are still happening. Adolescents have an increased need for companionship and reassurance of self-worth. Okay, so our kids loved being homeschooled. There was never any kind of, I want to go to public school, you know, all my friends are there, I'm missing out, all the fun, all the great fun is happening at public school. We didn't have to deal with that until our kids hit around 12 or 13. Right? That's when they started wanting more friends and more peer time. And it was really just one of our kids in particular that was really excited about that prospect. So, and this is typical, right? I would say for a lot of you, we don't have a lot of long-time homeschooled kids, but those of you in the audience who have been homeschooling for years, like some of the leaders and people, what was your experience? Did you hit some sort of experience like that where your kids at 11 or 12 or 13 or 14 started wanting more time with friends and more social time and more social relationships outside of the family, right? A lot of heads are nodding. Okay. So that's a thing, and that's normal. Right? So part of your plan for homeschooling has to include that. How are we going to handle, how are we going to manage, you could just give them the option, hey, if you want to go to public school once you're a teenager, you can. Or you could think about options that involve, like, how are we going to give these kids a really rich social network of friends and people they can interact with? What kind of clubs and groups and games are we going to get them into so that they feel like they've got all the social peer networking they need? Go ahead. Me too, I love this topic.
So my kids are 10 to 18, I have six. And we're hybrid homeschoolers, so we do give them, we make six decisions every year, just based on, lots of prayer and talking to them, deciding what the public school has to offer and what we have to offer and what the kid needs at that point.
Okay.
So every year looks a little different, but what our kids have found as they approach adolescence is, we live west of Buena Vista, okay, so we're even farther, rural Southwest Virginia, and there are limited opportunities, and so my adolescents have had the socialization opportunity of leadership and creating opportunities. So my daughter, when she was 15, decided that she really missed having a choir. And so she pulled together a couple of three families that we knew in the area, and she invited them over, and she formed a children's choir. And she led it, and she directed, and she accompanied, because she's really awesome on the piano. And she did it all, and I mentored, coached, and at one point took over the conducting so she could the leading, so she could accompany, because she's a lot better than I am. And anyway, so she did this beautiful children's choir, and they performed at the senior center and stuff like that. And then, so this year, my 16-year-old, who just finished her first year in college, she wanted to do a play. And so she read hundreds of plays and didn't like any of them, so she wrote her own. And we invited the same, you know, 3-4 families over. And she is directing and everything, and I am just watching, and she is doing it all and creating this play. So that's just what I love about homeschool socialization. The same 16-year-old in her English 111 class in college last semester, she wrote a paper on why homeschoolers were better socialized than public schoolers, and she had research to prove it. She went online, she found articles, she quoted them, she wrote the paper. The only comment her teacher had was absolutely flawless paper.
Oh, that's good. That's good. And you taught her everything she knows about writing, right? For the sake of the recording, it was a wonderful comment from a parent who was in an isolated area who still managed to help her children create social networks by putting on plays and starting a choir and things like that with other families that were in the area. Okay, let's go on. So adolescents have increased need for companionship and reassurance of their self-worth. Friendships. So adolescents accordingly depend on friends to meet this need more so than in middle childhood or in early childhood. So the ups and downs of their friendships increasingly shape their well-being. And if any of you have had teenage daughters, you know what I'm talking about, right? It's the idea that depending on what's going on in her friendship, she might be having a great day or a terrible day, right? And these kinds of things will happen. And I don't mean to pick on just daughters. Sons will do that too, to a degree, but not as much. Again, the quality of the friendship matters. Supportive friendships are what really matter. That's what helps adolescents. Peers. Okay. Peer pressure to resist parental influence peaks in adolescence, right? So this is that's one of the things to consider. You know, all of you, a bunch of you that raised your hands, you want to homeschool because you're concerned about some of these socializing agents that are trying to influence your children. Well, the reality is there are socializing agents that want to send messages to your children that are really counter to the purposes of a parent. Right? Messages that directly undermine, for example, your authority as a parent or your values or, you know, all kinds of things. So the pressure to conform peaks in adolescence. That's when you're going to get the most of the peer messages to your kids that are telling them that they should not listen to you or go try other things that you don't want them to try. Right? Conformity to peers peaks in 8th and 9th grade. So that's about what we see as far as kids getting sucked into the peer group. I don't know if you remember or not when you were in high school, but by the time you hit 10th or 11th grade or 12th grade, you're too cool to follow the crowd, right? Oh yeah, no, all those 8th graders, they're all just trying to, you know, no, I'm too cool for that, right? So teenagers get more sophisticated and intelligent, and suddenly they don't want to just follow the crowd. They want to do their own thing, right? Anyway, I got a graph here that shows self-disclosure across the grades for children, right? So what you have is the red line is friends. The blue line is parents. This is how much the child does, how much self-disclosure the child makes to parents and then to friends. And what you can see in the graph is that the self-disclosure to parents starts to decline right around 5th grade, right? 10th grade is the lowest point, and then it actually goes up in college. Your college kids will call you and talk to you, and it'll be refreshing, right? The friend's self-disclosure, as you can see, that line is the one that right around 5th grade, it starts to go up. Well, so less disclosure to parents, more disclosure to friends. And so you can see that some of those intimacy processes are really starting to happen with their friend group, right? Okay, so some conclusions. I'm going to keep watching my time. Okay, some conclusions about all the big picture here that I've been trying to give about socialization. First of all, parents matter most. So research supports the consensus among psychologists that parents are the most influential agents of healthy socialization. Hooray for you, right? So that means you can be a little less fearful, a little less concerned. You can actually make a big difference in your child's life. Parents are the most influential agents of socialization with respect to values. Again, that's got to be good news, right? There are some things, for example, their taste in music. Give it up. I mean, it's going to be really hard. Unless you're the musical family where your mom and dad sing and play instruments and all the kids, you know, if you're, you know, listening to classical music all the time, I mean, you could do that. But if they have friends and they have social media and they're going to start wanting to dress like other people and listen to music like their peers, and that kind of, the peer group has a lot of influence over things like that. but you have a lot of influence over what's most important, which is the value stuff, right? So hopefully that's good news for you. But and the values can actually drive then the taste in music and the way they dress and some of those other things if you do it right, right? So telling your kid, no, you cannot wear that, is not as helpful as pulling out For Strength of Youth and explaining to them the standards when they're 3 and 4 and 5 and reinforcing that message throughout the whole time they're growing up, right? Parents manage the influence of friends, peer groups, media, and other agents of socialization. And this is an important part of what you need to do to make sure those competing messages don't get to your kid, right? Don't win your kid over. They're going to get to your kid, but make sure that they don't win your kid over, right? So you manage the friends, the peer groups, the media, all those kinds of things. I'm not suggesting that we need to be Luddites and hide our kids away from all social media or anything like that. I just think you need to manage it and talk to your kids about it and help them be responsible with it. So here's one more thought. Marriage dynamics. The parents' own relationship matters a lot. And if you get a book about children and parenting and social development and stuff like that, a lot of times they don't talk about the marriage, they just talk about parenting. But there's this really clear pattern in the research that works like this. If mom and dad have a good marriage, as in good, healthy conflict resolution, low levels of aggression, good examples of supportiveness and, you know, making bids for support from each other and getting those bids acknowledged. Mom and dad have this good, healthy relationship. That directly affects children's social skills, as evidenced on the playground. We've got studies looking at the parents and how they interact and see that the kids use those same skills on the playground with other kids. So if mom and dad yell at each other, the kid's more likely to yell at other kids on the playground. What's that gonna do to the kid's popularity? What's that going to do to how many kids want to be that kid's friend, right? So you see this link here between the dynamics in the marriage to the social skills of the kid, to the friendship and popularity of the kid, which also could affect all kinds of, in public schools, that is also going to affect how well they do in school and all kinds of other things. But here, more importantly, the friendships and the friendship skills that the kid is developing is going to determine later dating relationships, the quality of those relationships. How good is the kid at managing that whole world of having relationships with members of the opposite sex? And then eventually, your dating ability and your dating success and skills and all that is going to lead to the quality of future marriage. So if part of what we're doing in socialization is helping children to grow up and develop into healthy adults who can sustain healthy relationships, then you and your marriage, we've been talking just about you as a parent, but you as a spouse, that's an important part of what you're doing too, right? Showing your child how adults live together happily in love, right? Let's go on. Conclusion number 2, supportive friendships are very important. Okay, so supportive friendships provide, this is stuff I've already said, provide practice, information, stimulation, personal resources, ego support, companionship, self-worth, and a standard for appropriate social comparisons. They also are, this is probably should have been the first slide of my presentation. I always bury the lead. This is terrible. Supportive friendships buffer children from stress and help them adjust to life transitions, right? When you have a friend, even if you only have one friend in public school is much easier to survive, right? Friendships buffer you from the stresses of life, right? Friendships versus family relationships. This is, again, more like Piagetian ideas about why are friendships special? Why does your kid need friends as opposed to siblings or parents or other people in their life? So Piaget makes his point that friendships, first of all, are freely chosen, right? Your brother is going to be your brother tomorrow no matter how badly you treat him, right? You're just kind of stuck with him, right? That's why we say family are those people that are there for you no matter what, because they have no choice, right? They're there for you. But your friend, if you treat him really badly, is not going to be your friend anymore, right? So there's a sense in which the fact that these are freely chosen relationships that are sustained only through your own mutual interest, that's a different kind of a relationship than a family relationship. So there's a balance of power, generally speaking, in friendships that you don't see in family relationships. So with siblings, there might be an older sibling and a younger, or with the parent and the child, one of them has more power and more resources available to them than the other. So it's not the same as two people on the same level trying to work out and negotiate and compromise and develop closeness and all that. It's a different kind of dynamic, right? And then the idea, like I said, of positive mutuality. Friendships imply you have to sustain a level of positive mutuality, or else the friendship, as I said, is going to fall apart. If you can't be friendly, then you won't maintain the friendship, right? So this is an important way in which we can just point to different ways in which friendships are going to do things for your kids that the siblings and the mom, dad, the mom, daughter, dad, daughter, mom, son, dad, son relationship isn't going to do. Okay, so let's get to some misconceptions. And this, I think the most important misconception is probably not the first one for some reason. But here we go. Friendships and peer groups. And how am I doing here on time? Friendships and peer groups are, and I should say, are not the same thing.
It's a misconception.
Oh, it's a misconception. Thank you. Oh, thank you. Who said that? I've got treats in a bag that they gave me, and you can have some later on. There you go. Thank you. So the influence of friends is different than the influence of peers. Unstructured, unsupervised peer group activity, particularly during early adolescence, pressures children to conform, creates stress for children, and generates a negative dynamic. In other words, it's an antisocial influence. People, for example, who have like intervention programs for teenagers for all kinds of different problems, like to prevent this problem or that problem, you get a bunch of teenagers and you try to create this group dynamic that will have a positive influence on the children. And there's a lot of research on how do you create a positive peer group dynamic among teenagers. And the research shows that it actually takes a lot of work and effort and training and energy, whereas the negative dynamic is the default, right? I don't know if you're aware or not, but during adolescence, people's emotions get a little more negative. That seems to be a human universal, that adolescence is associated with more negativity, more negative emotions being expressed, right? So the negative dynamic happens more frequently. You know, there's other reasons why it happens, because kids have poor impulse control and other things like that. So the idea here is that the peer group, the same age peer group, is not a positive influence in your children's life by nature. Like, it's not. If you've created a positive peer dynamic, like if there's structured activities and there's adult supervision and there's all kinds of precautions that are being taken to make sure that this is a good experience, then yeah, it can be very positive. But generally speaking, like the school cafeteria, the playground, places like that, a lot of times there's a whole lot of negative dynamic. There's a lot of negative interaction happening, right? And that can be stressful. Right, as I said, and that can put pressure on kids to conform to that kind of behavior, and it's generally going to be sort of antisocial behavior. So friendships, in the same way that they buffer children from stress, they buffer children from the negative effects of peer pressure. Right. So the reason you want your kids to have friends is because it's sort of a protective factor so that they don't get as much of the negative influence from the negative dynamic of the peer group. Right? Which is a very different way of thinking. Like, so a lot of people think, oh no, there's a lot of value. It's wonderful, it's great. Let's take all these kids and put them into same age peer groups for 18 years of their life because that's going to help them learn how to be an adult. Right? But the truth is, that's not how they're going to learn to be an adult. Right? There's a lot of negative antisocial stuff happening in that same age peer group for those 18 years. So if the kids have friends, that's what's going to help them to navigate that world more easily. Right? And hang on to the values that are happening in the home, right? Okay, misconception number two, socialization alone explains sociability and social skills. This is the idea that, oh my gosh, how many times does it happen to me where someone will say, well, look at this kid. This kid is so socially awkward, and he was homeschooled, right? And I always want to say, so you were public schooled, right?
Yeah.
Did you know any public school kids who were socially awkward? If I pointed to one of those and said it's because of public school, how would you respond to my argument, right? It's a reductionistic, it's crazily misinformed to think that you can point to one factor and say, you know, I've told you about how complicated socialization is and how nuanced it is. And the idea that there's just one factor, like because this happened, this kid's socially awkward now, right? That's kind of weird. Anyway, so here we go. Many factors influence sociability and social skills. Children are born different, for example. There's a biological thing going on there too, temperament, right? Temperament is sort of, I think I have a definition here. Temperament is defined as your child's typical pattern of behavior and emotional response to the environment. So temperament, there's different theorists who propose different models of temperament, different ways to classify. Like, this is the idea of, like, you've seen those books at the bookstore, like Barnes & Noble, that are like, you know, raising your difficult child, right? That kind of, like, it's that idea, right? That some children are more difficult than others. If you've had more than one kid, you might already know that some children are more difficult than others. I know that some children are more difficult than others because we had one of those difficult temperament children. But yeah, so temperament models have to do with things like, you know, easy, difficult, slow to warm up. That's one way to categorize them. Extroversion versus inhibition to the unfamiliar. This is the kid who, like, the difficult temperament kid is the kid who, like, you're teaching primary, right? And it's a beautiful day outside. And you say, kids, today we're going to go out and sit on the lawn and have a lesson outside. And one of the kids says, no, teacher, no, class is in here. We can't go out there. We're not supposed to have class out there. The kid's world is being rocked because you're changing his environment and you're changing his routine. Right, so kids who can't handle changes in routines, kids who don't take well to strangers easily, kids who, that's the difficult temperament kids, supposedly. One variety. Yeah, there's other kinds. But it's that idea. So kids are born different, so that's another reason to suppose. There might be a kid who's just really shy. There is a biological component to shyness, and he might be an introvert. And people might say, oh, he's not very social because he's homeschooled. We had a kid like that. That was our first kid, our oldest kid. He's a boy, and he's very quiet, and he's happy to sit and watch documentaries on PBS about dinosaurs for 6 hours at a time at age 5, right? This kid was, he didn't talk a lot when he was little. He thought he was a dinosaur, and dinosaurs don't talk. And so he walked up, it was the worst. It was, oh my gosh, it was like a homeschool parent's nightmare. He would walk up to other kids at the park, and he would go like this. That was his way of saying, hi, I want to be your friend, right? I was like, I guess for the people at home, I made the clawing motions of a dinosaur, right? That was my son at age 4 and 5, and he was, anyway, people would, like, oh yeah, it's homeschooled. Yeah, it's... But then you get my two daughters, and they're like these social extrovert, hyperfluent, you know, just like talkity-chatty. They're the friendliest, the most popular kids in the neighborhood. Everybody wants to come to our house and play with our daughters. They're cool, they're funny, they're friendly. They know all about clothes, and they're girly girls, but they're also athletic, and they're, yeah. And so people would see my kids sometime, and I'd say, come on over to my house and get a load of my daughters, right? And tell me what you think about homeschool, right? So anyway, so yeah, temperament is a thing. And sometimes people will confuse that with, you know, socializing influences, right? So temperament is relatively stable across early childhood. You can modify it to a degree, those of you who have a difficult child. The good news is you can help your child overcome a difficult temperament. The research shows that it's the goodness of fit between the way the parent parents and the child's temperament that really determines how the kid ends up in the long run, not the kid's temperament, right? So the biology in that sense isn't deterministic, right? Okay, misconception number 3, socialization is about conforming to peer behavior. This one, again, I probably think this is the one I most commonly deal with when I talk to people about socialization, so it probably should have been number 1. But, you know, at the heart of the socialization process is the idea that children are learning how to behave like adults. And I would encourage you to study. That's your lead, right? Socialization is about the process by which children learn how to behave like adults. Right. So how do children learn how to behave like adults? By interacting with socially competent, supportive adults. By observing socially competent, supportive adults who model appropriate behaviors for them. Right. By receiving direct instruction from socially competent, supportive adults. So more time with socially competent, supportive adults is always a good thing for children. That's going to be good. In other words, based on all of our theories and models of socialization, there's nothing that would lead us to think that if, assuming you are all socially competent, supportive adults, that your kid spending a whole bunch of time with you instead of in the same age peer group would somehow damage your child's socialization. I got to tell some stories. Sorry. I like telling stories. I don't like doing this. I like telling stories. When I talk to people, I usually tell stories. So here's a story. We got hit head-on by a drunk driver in Texas. That happens because in Texas, they have the highest rates of drunk driving head-on collisions. And so we were unlucky, and our children were hurt, and we went to court, and they had to appear in court. And we were in this courtroom for a long time with lawyers doing boring stuff and our kids sitting there. And at the end of this court hearing, the judge kind of like said, I got to say something before we close down the proceedings today. He said, I've been a judge for 32 years and I've never seen kids come and sit here and behave appropriately and respond intelligently to the questions and prompts. And, you know, like, he just said, what's your secret? What are you doing? How do you have these kids who seem like they're really mature and intelligent and like almost like adults, right? And I said, that thing that all parents do if they're smart, I said, oh, I guess we just got lucky, right? But the truth is we didn't just get lucky. We did a whole lot to socialize our children, and also our children weren't exposed to a lot of the negative stuff from the same age peer group, right? Another story, a friend of mine, this guy and I were gonna go off to do something, and he shows up at our house to pick me up, and I'm not ready yet, and I'm still getting ready, and I was out back mowing the lawn, and I had to run in and get dressed and all this. And meanwhile, he comes in our house and sits down, and he's talking with my son, who at the time was like 11 years old. And so I eventually, you know, I'm ready. We go out the door, we get in the car, and we're driving to where we're gonna go. And he says, you know what? I just had the weirdest experience. I said, what? And he said, I had a conversation with your son. And I said, oh, really? What did he say? No, you're not kidding. I had a conversation with your son. And I said, what do you mean? He said, it was like talking to an adult. He was like, he was socially savvy about like what I was saying, and he was helping to maintain the conversation, and he had intelligent things to say, and we were like, it was weird, you know? How do you have this 11-year-old that is so, you know, mature? And I said, you know, we got lucky, you know? This guy was already a homeschooler, so I didn't have to sell him on homeschool. So anyway, but he was still starting out in the process. But that's the kind of thing I'm talking about, is a lot of time with adults, if done the right way, helps your children to learn adult behaviors. Now, if you would have taken my 11-year-old and thrown him into the cafeteria with the other 11-year-olds, would he have known how to survive? Maybe not.
Probably.
He might have. He might not. I don't know, and I can't really say for sure. But if you threw me into the cafeteria with the 11-year-olds, would I know how to survive? I'm not sure that I would. I might say the wrong things, and I might not know how to dress and how to sit and what to do and what to say. I might be really uncool and stupid and nerdy. But that doesn't mean I don't know how to be an adult, right? So the skills that you need to navigate the cafeteria aren't necessarily the skills that you need in life in adulthood, right? So I think that's a big picture idea that you need to hang on to. So alternatively, learning to conform to peer behavior in the grade school cafeteria may have little overlap with learning how to behave like an adult. That's my point there. Okay, so socialization strategies. Manage their friendships. Make sure each child has at least one really good, solid, supportive friendship. Get them into groups and activities that will increase their likelihood of finding a supportive friend. And a lot of you already do this or can think of ways to do this. For Latter-day Saints, it's easy because you have like scouting, or at least till they're 13 now, you have scouting, and you have, the achievement days, and you have all these little things that your kids could be involved in, and friends from church, but neighborhood groups and homeschool groups and all that, get them into that stuff, right? Small play groups, play dates, teams, all that kind of stuff. Teach them about friendships. Give them the social knowledge they need. If you say nice things to the other children, they'll be more interested in being your friend. I remember having to explain that to my son once. Like, he was like 3 or 4 or whatever. It's like, if you keep doing this, you won't have friends, because that's not how friendships work. When the other boys roughhouse with you, it's their way. Oh, this is another one that I remember. A friend of mine told me, another dad told me, he had to explain this to his son. When other kids roughhouse with you, it's their way of saying they want to be friends. The trick is not to let things get too rough, because his son had punched some other kid, not understanding that it was a bid for friendship, right? Okay, shy child. Okay, so if you have the shy child, there's a book to read. Shy is probably something you want to deal with. Shy child is something you want to deal with. Now, there's a difference between shy and introverted. Introverted is perfectly normal. If you got an introverted kid, introversion, extroversion just means like, where do you get your energy from? What charges you? Some people, how many of you are the kind of people who, when you're out with people interacting and socializing, that charges your batteries and makes you feel more energized? Good. How many of you are the kind of people who you need downtime alone with books or quiet time to get energized? That's introversion versus extroversion, and both of those are perfectly acceptable and normal. And if you have a kid who's an introvert and wants to spend time with books to recharge, that's great. Shyness is a different issue, and like I said, there's a biological component, but there's really good strategies for dealing with it, so there's a book I'd recommend. Normalize gender differences. Okay, there's another thought. High T boys have lower needs for socializing and companionship. The bottom line is, like our son, I don't know that I'd classify him as a really high T boy, but compared to our daughters, he just had fewer needs for socialization. He was happy to just He didn't need that much friendship or that much social time, whereas our daughters wanted a whole lot more of it, right? So there are differences there, and sometimes there are gender differences, you might see them, but of course you can have really social boys as well. Testosterone, sorry. Yeah, testosterone. In research, they just say T for some reason. I don't know. Girls generally have greater needs for friendships, and friendships affect their well-being more intensely than they do boys, right? So another socialization strategy is to strengthen your marriage. Aspects of marriage that cross over into children's relationships with peers and friends include conflict resolution, level of aggression or violence, supportiveness, communication. All those are things that you should work on in your marriage and strengthen. Here's another thought. Pray for charity if you have those people that are really hounding you about socialization, right? Good strategy. Convey an informed opinion. Clarify opposing concerns. The intro that I gave you about values versus social incompetence, you know, help them to see that and then address their concern about social incompetence and explain your interest in the values thing, right? Describe the socialization process. Give them the big picture of what socialization is and how it works so that they can understand, especially that idea of that your whole ultimate goal is when your kids turn 18 or 19 or 20, he goes off to college and fits in the college world and succeeds in college and gets a career and gets married and gets, you know, this healthy, well-adjusted adult person, right? Offer conclusions, right? Parents matter most. Supportive friendships are very important. It's to tell them that. Say, hey, you know what? I'm concerned about socialization too. And the most important thing I'm going to do to make sure my kid has healthy socialization, I can provide a lot of it and I can manage a lot of it. And part of what I'm going to do is I'm going to make sure my kid has really good supportive friendships where he can practice intimacy and practice communication and all kinds of other things. And that's what I'm going to, you know, give them that kind of an idea or an argument. Correct misconceptions. For example, friendship and peer group are not the same thing. Socialization alone does not explain sociability and social skills. Socialization is not about conforming to peer behavior, right? The idea with that conforming to peer behavior is this. Well, if your first grader conforms to first grade behavior, and then when he's in second grade, he conforms to second grade behavior, and then when he's in third grade, he conforms to third grade behavior, on and on and on, and eventually he'll be an adult and he'll conform to adult behavior. That's what some people think socialization is, but that's not what it is. That's not how it works. Right. Other talking points. Okay. Limited studies to date. Okay. So I haven't talked a lot about the research. There is research. Here's my thought. I'm a scientist, and so I don't like to come and oversell research. There's a lot of research. There's not a lot. There's some research showing that homeschool kids have really healthy socialization, but it's not like peer-reviewed in research journals. It's usually supported by homeschool organizations that funded it. And usually there's a selection bias so that, you know, if you contact any homeschool parent and say, hey, we're doing a research study on homeschool parents and how well they do with their kids. Well, what are you going to say? Are you going to volunteer to participate in the study if your kid is a terror from, you know, Tasmania or something? No, you're going to say, oh, no, I'd rather not participate. But if your kid is like one of these superstar wonderful kids who's doing great and, you know, achieving and doing like putting on plays and starting choirs and all that. Yeah, my kid's awesome. Let's put me in the study, right? So there's a selection effect that happens in some of those studies. So it's hard to say conclusively that we've proven that homeschool is good for kids in terms of their socialization. But here's one thing I think I can clearly say based on the research, that there's nothing, there's no smoking gun, there's no evidence whatsoever that homeschooling would be, no compelling evidence that homeschooling would be bad for kids, and there is evidence that that homeschooling can still lead to very healthy, well-socialized children. Right. Did you want to ask a question?
I just have a comment. I mean, every homeschool right. kind to others.
Exactly. Okay. Let me wrap up so we can get to questions because we're running out of time quickly here. All right. So in recent years, there has been significant and sustained growth in home education around the world. That's another talking point, right? This is a big deal, and a lot of people are doing it all over the place, and we don't have this new sort of plague of antisocial children or unsocialized children. Anecdotal evidence, okay, there are quite a few sort of these anecdotal-like interviews and with college admissions people who will say, college admissions people like homeschooled kids, and that's one thing that you can clearly say based on all kinds of anecdotal evidence, right? In other words, they adjust better to college life, and they perform better in college and all those kinds of things. There, of course, is a selection effect there, too, but you can mention those things. Okay.
Any advice for
you know, that's a great question. The question is, this is an issue for the homeschooled kids themselves, that they will be sometimes made fun of or picked on, ridiculed or teased, or, you know, they'll, in other words, negative sort of social peer influence because they're homeschooled. Our kids got some of that. There was, and some of it happened even within a ward we were in once, you know, so there was kids in the ward who were really isolating our kids, and the bishop actually called a special meeting with all the, you know, the kids in the ward, all the youth, and said, we need to talk about this because this isn't right and all this. And so, you know, homeschooled kids aren't necessarily socially, you know, different or retarded or anything like that. And one of the kids raised his hand and said, but that's what my parents said. Right? And it's like, and my kids were in this meeting, right, where some of the kids were, yeah, like, it was just hard, right? So this is a real issue. And we used humor a lot, too. And I think kids benefit from this message, though, right? I think benefit from some of this. But as far as how you deal with it, I want to say that was probably the hardest thing for my two daughters about homeschool was some of the negativity they got from kids within an LDS culture, right? That was really hard for them to deal with. And we talked about it a lot, and we had family home evening discussions about how to deal with things like that. But I guess nothing's jumping into my head about, like, how do you deal with that? I think there was just a lot of us being trying to be sensitive to that issue, right?
Well, I'll propose a solution, that is that good of the
ward. Oh, wow. Okay, now I'm feeling really guilty as a parent because I don't know that we pray. That was a great story. So he shared an experience where their kids didn't have good friends as a buffer to help them, and so they prayed. And a couple of weeks later, a family moved into the ward, and the kids had friends. So there you go. Other questions? Go ahead.
Do you have any strategies to suggest for managing or building those supportive friendships with your children?
I think the kind of parenting things that you do with your kids to manage sibling rivalry and sibling conflicts, you're teaching them a lot of skills that translate into friendships. And so that would be like step number one, is to make sure that your kids know how to get along with their siblings, because a lot of that will translate out to. So if you see things happening that are inappropriate that you wouldn't want your kid doing with friends in the neighborhood, you shut it down in your home first, right? And that's going to give them a lot of the skills. It's going to equip them with what they need to go out and start friendships. And friendships will be a little bit different, but a lot of the skills translate over, right? If that makes sense. And then as far as like managing those friendships, I think quite literally you need to find out like who are the people in the ward, who are the people in the neighborhood. You need to there's management work that you need to do there to figure out where are the kids and where are the kids that would be a good fit, you know, that my kids that like and want to hang out with. I mean, with girls, it's not such a complicated question. You ask a girl, who do you want to be your friend, and they'll start naming all kinds of people that they're interested in. And with boys, it might be harder, and you got to find boys really are going to connect through activity. So you'll find what are the activities you're interested in, and let's get you into those activities, and then you'll make friends in those activities, right? Okay, other questions? Go ahead.
That's your brother.
Yeah.
But you could maybe choose to be their friend.
Yeah, thank you. That's a brilliant. You're right. That's a brilliant point, and I don't. Okay, here's the truth of the story. I haven't told you the whole truth. If you ask my daughter, Soraya, who her best friend in the world is, she'll say her brother, Nathaniel. She's an adult. She's 26 now. He's 28. They talk on the phone every... She's married. He lives here in Virginia. She's in Utah. They talk almost every night on the phone. They have a really close friendship. She's been bugging him for the longest time to go to his grad program in BYU, and so in the end it worked out. She was praying and fasting, and that was the best offer he got. So he's going to BYU. She lives in Provo. They're going to see each other all the time, I'm sure. And they're really good friends. Same thing with my other daughter. They're a little bit closer because they were closer in age. But then the other daughter, same thing. They have this little network, and they're still very close. And so I think the idea of choosing to make your siblings your friends, I think you can do that. There is a way to do that. And I think in isolated areas, I've seen homeschool families where the siblings did sort of fulfill that need to work like the friendship group, right? Like, because they had, in terms of how the family structured the discipline and everything in the home, they made it work, right? So it's not like in an isolated area, I would assume there's going to be less negative peer influence too that you need to protect your kid from, right? So maybe the sibling relationships would be enough. But I think you can have siblings that operate a lot like friendships, right? It probably doesn't work as well. Like my son to my daughter, it wasn't the youngest daughter and the oldest son, because of the age difference and the power level difference, they weren't friends when they were little. But only now, as they got to, they're both adults now and they're both living on their own, and now the friendship is really taking off, right? What's another question? Did I answer your question kind of?
Yeah,
okay.
I guess I'm
thank you. Yeah, thank you. So another comment about a parent who helped the siblings to become very good friends with each other. I would still say, though, that there's going to be, for a lot of you, there's going to be that whole 13-year-old kid who wants to have more experience outside of the home, right? I want to have friends. I want all that. So the siblings might help, but not when you're 13, right? That might be the hard, the difficult spot. Other questions? Go ahead.
In other areas.
I know where you're going. Like, you want to get your kid ready for that.
Yeah. So, you know, like it's.
I know where you're going. I've heard it before.
Awful. Like when you think of other things, it's like, well, I want my kids to have drugs because later on they might, you know, like whatever. It seems really dumb, but
yeah.
There are things that I feel like, you know, how can I replicate some of those things that translate into the dynamic when they are adults.
So, and here's a good, related to that is the idea of, I want my kids in that environment now so that they'll be ready when they're adults. And I always tell the people, like, my metaphor is the Shark Tank metaphor, right? Like, the world is a dangerous place and you got to know how to survive. And it's like, you know, okay, you want to throw your kid in the Shark Tank when they're 5 or when they're 18? You know, what's the better chance of your kid surviving, right? You want to throw your kid in the Shark Tank when they're 18. You want to prepare them for the Shark Tank. And I think you can do it in lots of ways. But what I found was, even though we homeschooled, we had a lot of limited media. We let our kids play with kids in the neighborhood. We let our kids go to church and be involved in church things. We got them into other groups and clubs and things. And they knew a lot of nasty stuff. The nastiness of the world got to them. So you can't, unless you really like move out to the middle of North Dakota on a farm and raise your kids in isolation. Okay, we're done. She said end, so we're done. Thank you very much.
Latter-day Saint Home Educators is a nonprofit, all-volunteer organization dedicated to providing inspiration to homeschool families. We hope you enjoyed this recording. If you are interested in listening to more recordings or would like to participate in a future conference, please visit our website at ldshe.org.